Chapter 11. Fermenting Beans, Seeds, and Nuts. Beans are important elements of most agricultural food systems, if only for their nitrogen-fixing impact upon soil. Actually, the work of soil bacteria, rhizobium, that thrive in legume root nodules, metabolizing atmospheric nitrogen into the soil. But legumes also provide critical nutrients to both people and the animals we keep. For many people, they have made the difference between life and death, writes historian Ken Albala in Beans, A History. Beans are practically indestructible if thoroughly dried and well stored, and thus have provided critical insurance against times of famine and death. Beans provide efficient nourishment, and many regions with high population densities depend upon them. But in Europe and the so-called developed nations, only those people who could not afford meat depended on beans. Thus, beans became a marker of class, the quintessential peasant food, or poor man's meat. The same indestructibility that makes beans such important storage foods can also render them difficult to digest. As with grains, only perhaps more so. Soybeans in particular have enzyme inhibitors that render the bean's protein indigestible. Beans are notorious in folkloric humor in many cultures for the flatulence they cause. Along with soaking and often long cooking, fermentation has been used as a strategy to diminish antinutrients and toxins, and thereby render the beans more digestible and their nutrients more available. Curiously, this strategy has been used extensively in Asia and to a lesser degree in Africa, but not at all in Western culinary traditions, despite the presence of both legumes and fermentation. No other edible bean necessitates fermentation for its effective digestion, as soybeans do. But the techniques used to ferment soybeans can be effectively applied to other beans. Nuts and seeds also frequently have toxic anti-nutrient compounds that can be removed by fermentation. Certain seeds and nuts, such as acorns, require long soaking to leach toxins, which inevitably also initiates fermentation. Before delving into the fermentation of beans, I will briefly cover some ways of fermenting seeds and nuts, beyond tossing some in, raw, roasted, salted or not, whole or pieces, however you have them, with your fermenting vegetables, which can be quite lovely. Cultured seed and or nut cheeses, pâtés, and milks. Nuts and edible seeds, such as sesame, sunflower, pumpkin, and flax, are rich and oily and can be ground or crushed, with or without other ingredients, into delicious cheeses, pâtés, and milks. These are creamier and tastier if the nuts and or seeds are soaked before grinding and may be enjoyed fresh or cultured and fermented. I think of seed and nut cheeses and pâtés as existing along a continuum, depending upon texture and what is mixed in. Both pâté and pesto, as well as pestle, come from Latin pestare, to pound or crush. Typically, what I know as pesto would contain a relatively low proportion of seeds and nuts, along with mostly basil or other greens, olive oil, and garlic. A seed or nut cheese, on the other hand, might be 95% seeds or nuts, with just a little liquid or oil, and just a few herbs or none. A pâté could really be anywhere in between. But the point here is that any of them may be cultured and fermented. I have generally cultured seed and nut concoctions with sauerkraut juice, pickle brine, or miso. You could also try whey, raw soy sauce, sourdough, especially the liquid that separates at the top, Rejuvelac, or other living cultures incorporating acid-producing bacteria. I have done these pâtés and cheeses as short-term ferments, overnight or a couple of days. Stir daily and taste. Like everything, they ferment faster in heat, slower in cool. When the taste is perfect, enjoy them fresh, or refrigerate for a few days to slow fermentation. If these go too long, they can become excessively sharp and, to some, unpleasant. Eventually, proteins will putrefy. Nut or seed milks may also be fermented, although personally I have little experience with this. Linda Gardner Phillips reports on her experiences fermenting milk she makes from cashew nuts and dates. The first time it fermented was an accident, but I smelled it and realized it smelled very pleasantly sour, like buttermilk or sourdough starter, which I remembered my father making when I was a child. Linda uses her cashew and date milk as a sourdough starter. Another fermentation experimentalist, Shosh, writes that she uses sprouted sunflower seeds rather than sprouted grains to ferment Rejuvelac. Acorns. Acorns, the nuts of oak trees, are edible and in fact have been a critical source of nutrients for many native peoples in North America and elsewhere. In mainstream culture, however, acorns are largely ignored as a food for human consumption. Meanwhile, ironically, the imminent threat of global food shortages is continually being used to justify deforestation and intensifying biotechnology. I'm not saying anyone should subsist on acorns alone, but let's tap into the abundant food resources we already have rather than acting based upon the myth of overall scarcity. Gather acorns in the fall. Reject any with visible wormholes. Air dry acorns before storing. It is not a problem if acorns have already begun to sprout. California acorn enthusiast Sue Ellen Ocean writes, "I like to gather sprouted acorns because the sprouting increases the acorn's nutritional value. It is no longer in a starch stage, but has changed to a sugar stage. The sprouting also helps split them from the shell. It is beneficial because if it has sprouted, it's a good acorn, and I haven't wasted time gathering wormy ones. I've found that an acorn with a 2-inch long sprout is fine as long as the acorn nut meat hasn't turned green. I break off the sprout and continue." It is important to note that the acorns of many oak trees contain high levels of tannins and require leaching prior to consumption. To do this, remove acorns from their shells, grind, and soak in water. You can grind acorns dry using a mortar and pestle or mill, or mix acorns with water and grind in a blender or food processor. Acorns should be finely ground to expose lots of surface area, enabling the tannins to leach out. Acorns can be leached in a fine mesh bag in a running stream, this is the fastest method, or in a series of soaks that can last for a few days. As acorn meal soaks, the meal will settle at the bottom of the vessel and the water will darken. Gently pour off the dark water at least daily and discard. Water will darken less with each soak as tannin levels decrease. Keep rinsing with fresh water until it no longer darkens. If you wish to ferment acorn meal, leave it to soak a few more days in just a small amount of water after the tannins have been leached. Acorns can be used to fortify and flavor many different foods. Once, I made acorn gnocchi, which were excellent. Julia F. Parker of the Miwok Paiute people in California's Yosemite Valley wrote a beautiful book about acorn preparation called It Will Live Forever, in which she describes traditional techniques for making a simple porridge, nuppa, using only leached acorn meal and water, which is delicious. And on a website devoted to the language of another California tribe, the Kato, I came across reference to fermented acorn / acorn cheese, ch'int'an'nu'ul. I have not found further information on fermented acorn cheese, nor have I experimented, but I include this tidbit in the hope that other acorn-loving fermenters will experiment in this vein. Coconut oil. Fermentation can be used to extract coconut oil from coconuts. This simple process, brought to my attention by fermenter Keith Nicholson of Franklin, North Carolina, requires mature brown coconuts with hard flesh. The first step is to open the coconuts and remove the flesh. Then blend the coconut flesh with water to create a slurry and strain out the solids, pressing to extract as much coconut milk as possible. Place the coconut milk in a jar, crock, or bowl in a warm spot and leave to ferment a day or two. As it begins to ferment and acidify, the coconut oil separates and rises to the top. Refrigerating solidifies the oil for easy removal. Cacao, coffee, and vanilla fermentation. These exotic tropical beans are everyday foods in affluent parts of our globalized world. Few people realize that they involve fermentation, which occurs post-harvest in the tropical places where these plants grow. I have no personal experience with them. The following descriptions are gleaned from the literature. Cacao, Theobroma cacao. Following harvest, pods are cut open and seeds, enmeshed in a white, sweet pulp, are removed. The seeds are piled in heaps or vats and covered with banana leaves, weighted with earth or sand to ferment, writes Bill Mollison. Fermentation takes place over 2 or even 10 days, the heap turned twice daily, when they rinse clean easily. The turning is in order to release heat accumulating in the center and prevent overheating. The microbes work like a symphony orchestra, offers Jeanette Farrell, with a vivid metaphor for community succession. Apparently, the fermentation depends to a considerable extent upon how tightly the pulpy beans are packed, writes microbiologist Carl Peterson. Well-aerated beans would favor fermentation by yeasts and acetic acid bacteria, while tightly packed beans would favor a lactic acid fermentation. All three are typically present. Chocolate precursors are formed immediately after the death of the seed, explains Peterson. The death of the seed is caused by the acid and alcohol and the heat produced by the microbial fermentation. Beans are ready when the tree embryo within the seed is appropriately shriveled, according to Farrell. If the beans are not dried, the organism can begin to break down the embryo itself and fungi can begin to grow, adding their rich but not necessarily desirable flavors. Coffee, Coffea species. Fruits the size of small cherries each contain two beans. Each is wrapped in a membrane and embedded in yellow pulp. The fermentation digests this pulp, freeing the berries. Fermentation involves placing the beans in plastic buckets or tanks and allowing them to sit until the mucilage is broken down, according to the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization. Natural enzymes in the mucilage and yeasts and bacteria in the environment work together to break down the mucilage. The coffee should be stirred occasionally, and every so often a handful of beans should be tested by washing in water. If the mucilage can be washed off and the beans feel gritty rather than slippery, the beans are ready. Peterson reports, the fermentation of coffee cherries is spontaneous and involves a variety of microorganisms. Under-fermentation interferes with the normal drying process, while over-fermentation results in adverse changes that affect the flavor and aroma. Vanilla, Vanilla species. Vanilla is the fermented and dried seed pods of several species of orchids. Pods are harvested before they ripen, when the bottom of the pod begins to turn from green to yellow. If left on the vine to ripen, the pods split open, exposing the seeds and making them practically worthless. There are several different methods of curing, typically involving scalding the pods in hot water, then sweating them for several days. This process encourages dominance by heat-tolerant bacteria of the genus Bacillus. Vanilla pods are fully cured when fine, needle-like crystals develop on the surfaces. Then the cured pods are typically extracted into alcohol for use as a flavoring. Spontaneous fermentation of beans. The rest of this chapter will consider the fermentation of beans, meaning mature, dried beans. Fresh beans are fermented as vegetables, sometimes raw, sometimes cooked, Chapter 5. Dried beans may also be sprouted and then fermented raw with vegetables. But other than that, at least by tradition, fermented beans are always cooked before and or after fermentation. The microbial context for the fermentation is very different depending upon whether or not the beans have been cooked beforehand. Raw beans are fermented spontaneously in a group of Indian ferments known as idli and dosa, along with many variations, and in an Afro-Brazilian preparation, acarajé. In each case, after fermentation, the raw fermented batter is cooked. When beans are cooked before fermentation, the kinds of organisms that spontaneously ferment beans are destroyed by heat, and the beans become a microbial blank slate, like pasteurized milk, prone to putrefaction. Therefore, ferments of cooked beans are typically cultured with starters. Tempeh, covered in the last chapter, relies on molds, primarily Rhizopus oligosporus, while miso and soy sauce rely on different molds, of the genus Aspergillus, as well as mixed bacterial starters in the form of mature miso. Like many ferments around the world, the original sources of these common microbes were various plants in a raw state. The one bacterial spore that typically survives on beans after cooking is the hardy Bacillus subtilis, which transforms soybeans into the Japanese soybean delicacy known as natto, and a range of similar bean ferments enjoyed elsewhere in Asia and Africa. If the Rhizopus or Aspergillus molds overheat and die while growing on beans, B. subtilis is present and will typically succeed them. Idli, dosa, dokla, common. Idli are steamed cakes of fermented rice and lentils, popular in southern India. Dosai, the plural of dosa, are delicate, paper-thin crepes of a thinner version of exactly the same batter. Other variations on the theme include dokla and common. To make idli or dosai, start by separately soaking rice and black gram dal, or other lentils, overnight. Proportions vary in different recipes. Steinkraus reports that the proportions of rice to black gram vary from 4 to 1 to 1 to 4, depending upon the relative cost on the market. I like 2 to 3 parts rice, 1 part red lentils. Many recipes call for fenugreek seeds as well, in much smaller proportion, which contribute microbes as well as flavor. To make batter, blend or pound the soaked rice, lentils, and fenugreek seeds into a slurry, adding water as necessary. For idli, you need a fairly thick batter. For dosai, add more water to thin. Add a little salt and leave to ferment 12 to 48 hours, depending upon temperature. Typically, no starter is added and no starter is necessary, but you can add yogurt, kefir, a bit of mature batter, or other starters. You can also add other herbs or spices if desired, though traditionally they are made simply and embellished via toppings, dosa, stews, idli, and chutneys. I like to ferment idli/dosa batter in glass, no more than 2/3 full, so I can see its dramatic rise. Once the batter is visibly rising, you can cook it into idli or dosa. If you let it rise too long, it can exhaust its nutrients and lose its rising power, much like bread can. For idli, steam the batter in special forms designed for this purpose, or in any improvised steamer. One good improvisational technique is to wrap fermented batter in corn husks, like tamales, and steam them. Steam about 20 minutes until well set. Idli is frequently served with a spicy vegetable dal called sambar. For dosa, the batter must be much thinner and spread in as thin a layer as possible on a well-seasoned and oiled or stick-free pan. Dokla are similar to idli, only using different legumes and steamed in a different form. Dokla are typically made with dehulled Bengal gram dal and rice. My friend Sean, who has visited family in India, reports that his favorite dokla are made with chickpeas. The batter is steamed in larger forms, or greased pie tins. After steaming, dokla are cut into small squares to be served. The way I've experienced dokla, once the cake has been steamed, mustard seeds are popped in oil with a pinch of asafoetida, a botanical flavoring used in Indian cooking, explains Sean. The mixture is spread on top of the dokla, which is then sprinkled with unsweetened coconut shreds and coriander leaves. Khaman is exactly like dokla, except that no rice is used. The batter is made of dehulled Bengal gram dal, or other legumes, mixed only with water and salt. Dosa variations. Oris Fei, New Mexico. I have made dosa with forbidden rice, a black rice, which created a dark purple dosa, with red dal, which created a pink dosa, and with risotto rice, as well as yellow and white dal. As long as the ratio is 2 rice to 1 dal, all of these variations have been successful. Adding chopped green chili to the batter has been great. We live in New Mexico. And I have also added minced garlic and diced onion to the batter, and often add turmeric, as that creates a nice golden dosa. I make the dosai in a crepe pan, and I do not thin the batter to the degree that they do in Indian restaurants. We have had dosai in restaurants that are very thin and, in my opinion, quite tasteless. I make the dosai the thickness of a tortilla, so then they work very well as a wrapper for various fillings. I often take ground turkey or ground lamb and mix seasonings and diced onions, etc., into the meat. Add a few tablespoons of coconut fiber and an egg to help hold things together, and shape the meat mixture into torpedo shapes so that they will fit nicely in a dosa. We also eat dessert dosai by wrapping a dosa around fresh fruit, whipped cream, homemade applesauce, and so on. We like the sourness of the dosa with the sweeter filling ingredients. Acarajé, Afro-Brazilian fritters of fermented black-eyed peas. These Brazilian fry breads made from fermented black-eyed peas are creamy, light, and delicious. My sister thought they tasted like latkes, potato pancakes. I learned about them from Selma Miriam of the Bloodroot Collective, which has operated a fermentation-friendly, feminist vegetarian restaurant in Bridgeport, Connecticut for more than 30 years. Acarajé comes from the Brazilian state of Bahia. And like black-eyed peas themselves, it is a transplant from West Africa, known as acara in Yoruba. Making acarajé is pretty straightforward. Soak black-eyed peas overnight. 1 cup, 1/2 pound, or 250 milliliters, 250 grams, of peas will feed 4 to 6 people. After soaking, try to remove as many of the hulls from the beans as you can. While they are submerged, stick your hands in the water and roll the peas between the palms of your hands, pressing and moving your hands in circles in opposite directions to try to remove the skins from the beans. You may need to reach in and squeeze the beans between your thumbs and index fingers, or pound the peas with a heavy blunt tool. Periodically rinse and swirl the water so the detached skins will float to the top. Remove them and discard. Add more water if necessary and repeat a few times. The more skins you get off, the smoother the batter will be, but you probably will not get them all. At least, I never have. Then, blend the soaked dehulled peas with a coarsely chopped onion, a chili pepper, salt, and pepper. Blend well, or crush in a mortar and pestle, into a paste. Add just a little water if necessary to moisten and bind. Leave the paste slash batter in a bowl to ferment. The bloodroot recipe called for fermenting it for only 1 to 4 hours, but I have been experimenting with longer fermentation. I've gotten as far as about 4 days, and so far they just keep getting tastier. After several more days, exactly how many depends upon temperature, saltiness, and other factors, it ceases to get sharper and begins to develop more putrid flavor notes. In Brazil, a acarajé is usually cooked by deep-frying the batter in palm oil. It is indeed delicious deep-fried, though I have mostly pan-fried it in just a little oil as pancakes. Either way, use whatever oil you like. Just before cooking the batter, beat it for a good long while to make it smooth and stiff, adding water just a little at a time as necessary. This beating changes the batter dramatically, making it much, much creamier. As with cream or egg whites, the beating both develops the batter's capacity to hold air and whips air bubbles into it. Proteins have a tendency to unfold and bond to each other when they're subjected to physical stress, explains Harold McGee in a different context. Thus, disturbed and concentrated, they readily form bonds with each other. So, a continuous solid network of proteins pervades the bubble walls, holding both water and air in place. Beat acarajé batter until it is stiff and maintains peaks. I've done it in small quantities with a hand whisk, beating about 10 minutes. You could use any tool you would use beating cream or egg whites, such as a mechanical or electrical mixer, or a food processor with a paddle. It never before occurred to me to beat legumes, but it's so light and fluffy. Acarajé is a common street food in Bahia, typically deep-fried, cut open, and served covered or stuffed with stew and or sauce, often with shrimp. A quick online search will yield many enticing accompaniments. In Nigeria, the same batter is also boiled or steamed in a banana leaf and called abara. To steam as abara, leave the batter fairly thick, wrap in a corn husk, with a tasty morsel buried inside if desired, tie with twine and steam about 20 minutes, as for tamales. Soybeans. Most of the rest of the traditional bean ferments I know developed in relation to soybeans in China, Japan, Korea, Indonesia, and other parts of Asia. Historian Ken Albala points out that China's rulers have been promoting soy agriculture for nearly 3 millennia, and that China's long stability as a civilization and empire has helped give rise to, spread, and perpetuate such elaborate transformations of the bean. Except for edamame, which are soybeans cooked while they are fresh, before they are dried, soybeans are rarely eaten merely cooked, because anti-nutrient factors the dried beans contain, including enzyme inhibitors and the highest phytate content of any legume or grain, make them difficult to digest. In China and elsewhere in Asia, dried soybeans are almost always either fermented or else processed into milk, curdled, and pressed into tofu, in a process similar to cheese making. Because soybeans were not generally eaten intact, early accounts of European travelers to Asia rarely recognized the connection between the bean and the foods made from it, according to Albala. The earliest interest in the plant in the United States was as a soil-building cover crop and animal forage rather than a food crop for humans. Several unrelated events spurred a rapid growth of U.S. soy agriculture in the early decades of the 20th century. World War I food shortages created demand for meat substitutes and cooking oil. The need for new sources of vegetable oil was compounded by a boll weevil infestation of U.S. cotton crops in the 1920s. New developments in plant breeding led to soy varieties better suited to the Midwestern United States, where farmers found the crop a good complement to corn. In addition, improvements in agricultural technology, as well as government agricultural policy, favored soybean production. Decreased reliance on draft animals meant that millions of acres that had been pasture could be converted to crops, including soy. And as pigs, which eat soy meal, largely replaced horses on American farms, this further stimulated agricultural demand for soy. Bigger and better tractors and combines, which enabled greater labor efficiency, made U.S. soy more competitive on the world market. Finally, U.S. farm policies during the Depression, which aimed to maintain prices to support the farm economy by limiting production of corn and other crops, placed no restrictions on soybean acreage. Technology encouraged not only soy production, but also innovations in how it was used. In 1934, the Archer Daniels Midland Company, ADM, derived lecithin from soybean oil, which quickly found numerous industrial applications. One important business leader who saw opportunity in soybeans was Henry Ford, who funded much research seeking ways to incorporate them into car manufacturing. Ford, who grew up on a farm, was eager to support farmers on a large scale and showcased a prototype automobile in 1941 with a body made of soy-based plastic. Soy is now commonly found in cars as well as computers and is used in oils, paints, plastics, inks, cosmetics, and countless other industrial applications, including food processing. World War II shortages of butter and cooking oil introduced American consumers to margarine and shortening made from soy oil by means of a newly developed hydrogenation process. To meet wartime demand, U.S. soy production increased rapidly, and during the war, the United States became the world's largest grower, surpassing China. Wartime necessity became an agreeable and economical convenience during peacetime, writes Sidney Mintz. Today, soy is among the top U.S. cash crops, and not coincidentally, 93% of that crop consists of a variety genetically modified for tolerance to the herbicide Roundup. Given the nature of genetic drift, the engineered genes can be expected to show up in the other 7%, legal prohibitions against genetically modified ingredients in organic products notwithstanding. Like genetic modification, soy is largely invisible to consumers, its oil hardly ever marketed with the word soybean on the front label, observes Mintz. Oil, lecithin, proteins, and other forms of fragmented soy are present in nearly all processed foods, but rarely receive any marketing prominence. And most of the soy Americans consume, they eat indirectly through chicken and pork. If you count that, because we eat so much of these meats, U.S. per capita consumption of soy is considerably higher than Japan's. The only time soy gets talked about as food is as a meat alternative or for purported health benefits. Health food promoter John Harvey Kellogg wrote about soy as a high-protein meat alternative as early as 1921. With the explosion of vegetarianism in Western countercultures in the 1970s, soy milk and tofu were embraced as substitutes for milk and meat. Paradoxically, this crop of prime importance to agriculture and industry became what historian Warren Belasco has termed the icon of the counter cuisine. The soy industry has sought to increase soy's appeal to the mainstream as a functional food by funding research to support its use as a therapy for menopausal women and to reduce risk of cancer, heart disease, and atherosclerosis and bone loss. But increasingly, healthcare practitioners and advocates are questioning these benefits and identifying problems that may be caused by consumption of unfermented soy. Nutritionist Kayla Daniel, in her book The Whole Soy Story, The Dark Side of America's Favorite Health Food, presents evidence that high consumption of unfermented soy may play a role in many growing health problems, including irregular sexual development of fetuses, infants, and children, diminished cognitive ability, accelerated brain aging, and increased likelihood of Alzheimer's disease, infertility and suppressed reproductive functioning, heart arrhythmias, thyroid disorders, and increased risk of certain cancers. The list goes on and on. Herbalist Susan Weed, veteran of decades of treating people who replaced milk and meat with soy milk and tofu, summarizes, "When unfermented soy is eaten frequently in a diet low or lacking in animal protein, the anti-nutritional factors can create havoc, brittle bones, thyroid problems, memory loss, vision impairment, irregular heartbeat, depression, and vulnerability to infections." Almost all of the critiques of soy that I have seen pertain to unfermented soy. If you want to eat soybeans, fermented is definitely the best way to do so. Use organic soybeans if you wish to try to avoid genetically modified foods. And almost anything you can do with a soybean, you can do with other beans, albeit with different results. Don't worry too much about it. Soy and other beans are improved in many ways by fermentation. Miso. Miso is a Japanese form of fermented bean paste. It is made by mashing well-cooked beans with koji, grain grown with the mold Aspergillus oryzae, salt, and often mature miso and/or other ingredients. Japanese tradition encompasses many different varieties and regional styles of miso. The Book of Miso by William Shurtleff and Akiko Aoyagi is the definitive English language guide to miso, with much information on different traditional varieties. Miso's range of flavors and colors, textures and aromas is at least as varied as that of the world's fine wines or cheeses, writes Shurtleff and Aoyagi in another epic volume covering the history of miso. My own experience has been more experimental. Guided by Shurtleff and Aoyagi's presentation of the basic methods, I have incorporated every bean I could think of and over time used higher proportions of koji and eventually vegetables. I started using more koji because I learned how to make my own, described in detail in the previous chapter. Once I experienced koji's alluring aroma and how potent it is fresh, and was unburdened from the considerable expense of buying it, my koji proportions increased. What I like about misos with high proportions of koji is that they generally use much lower proportions of salt and don't require cool cellar conditions for long aging. This is the basic process for making miso. Before you can make miso, you need koji, which you can either make yourself as described in Chapter 10, or obtain from commercial sources. Soak beans for miso overnight in enough water to keep them covered as they expand. In the morning, cook the beans in fresh water. As the beans come to a boil, skim off and discard any foam that accumulates at the surface, especially with soybeans. I usually add some kombu seaweed to the cooking beans. Cook until the beans are soft and easy to crush, how long varying with the type of bean, up to as much as 6 hours for soybeans. Overcooking is not a problem, just be sure to stir the bottom frequently so you don't burn the beans. After cooking, drain the beans through a colander into a pot or bowl and reserve the cooking liquid. Pour a little hot bean cooking liquid, or boiling water, over the measured amount of salt to cover, stir to start dissolving the salt, and set aside. Next, mash the beans. Typically working in 5-gallon, 20-liter, batches, I like to place beans in a big pot on the floor and mash from above with my supersized masher, also marketed as a cement mixer, adding bean cooking liquid and/or water as necessary to get a pasty consistency. You can mash the beans into a smooth, homogeneous texture using any number of tools, or leave them somewhat chunky, as you prefer. It is my understanding that miso has traditionally been enjoyed chunky, and only in the context of relatively recent mass production has it been widely mashed and milled into the smooth product commercially available. You can strive for that, or enjoy a coarser texture, as I do. Before adding koji to the bean mash, evaluate temperature. Koji enzymes can tolerate temperatures up to about 140 degrees Fahrenheit, or 60 degrees Celsius. But be sure not to add it to beans hotter than that, or hotter than you can comfortably touch. If after mashing your beans are still too hot, leave them to cool longer, stirring frequently to release heat from the center. Once the beans are sufficiently cooled, add koji and stir and/or mash it in. Now you can return to the salt you covered with hot water and/or bean cooking liquid earlier, which should have cooled to around body temperature by now. If you're making a long-aging, high-salt miso, add live, unpasteurized, mature miso to this and stir to thoroughly distribute. The mature miso you add is sometimes called seed miso because it serves as a starter, introducing lactic acid bacteria and other organisms that develop in miso in addition to the koji mold. Any unpasteurized miso, including commercially available ones, may be used for this. Short-fermenting misos typically rely on the koji exclusively and do not incorporate seed miso because that would hasten souring. Whether or not you add seed miso, add the salt mixture to the mashed beans and koji. Add vegetables, more on that soon, or any additional ingredients you desire. Add further bean liquid or water to achieve a paste that is moist and easily spreadable, but thick enough to hold its shape and not runny. If miso is warm, it will continue to thicken as it cools. Also, koji will absorb some of the water, especially if it is dry rather than fresh. If the miso seems too dry at any point, mix in more water in small increments. Once the miso ingredients are well mixed, they need to be packed into a crock for aging. As you add miso to your crock, take care to pack down each addition, leaving no air pockets, which could result in internal mold growth and a musty flavor. After being packed into the crock, fermenting miso needs to be pressed down as it ages. In my experience, there is no avoiding this, as there is with vegetables, which you can ferment tightly packed into a jar. The initial koji fermentation of the miso is extremely active and expansive. I learned this once when I had some extra prepared miso left over after packing the rest of the batch into a 5-gallon crock. I packed the extra miso into a jar and left it, loosely capped, in the basement. When it caught my eye again about a week later, the miso had pushed off the cap and erupted up out of the jar, over the sides, and all around. Miso needs to be weighted down to hold it together in its vessel and prevent it from exploding or escaping. And it also needs to be able to release gas. I always make miso in ceramic crocks, covered with plates or hardwood discs, usually weighted down by a 1-gallon, 4-liter, jug of water, with an old sheet or other cloth covering the top, tied tight around the crock with string as a barrier to flies and dust. The setup is exactly as I use for sauerkraut. You could also use a heavy or multiple-layer plastic bag filled with water as a cover and weight, especially useful in a jar or other vessel that is not cylindrical and has a mouth smaller than its internal size. You need to think ahead about where to age your miso, as the options you have available have implications for what kind of miso it makes sense for you to make. Sweet miso, which ferments for relatively short periods of time, roughly 2 to 6 weeks, can age in a variety of environments. Warmer temperatures will make them ferment faster, cooler, slower. Sweet miso uses a high proportion of koji and low proportion of salt. Longer fermenting salty miso, which ferments for a minimum of about 6 months, and often for years, needs to be stored in an unheated space protected from temperature extremes, such as a cellar, especially if you age them beyond the minimum. These longer fermenting misos generally use higher proportions of salt and lower proportions of koji. Only attempt these longer fermenting misos if you have a suitable place to age them. If your living space is entirely heated, it's better for you to make a sweet miso. After a year or more in a heated space, miso can be shrunken and hard as a brick. I've seen it happen. The simple proportions I work with are roughly equal amounts of beans and koji for sweet miso, with about 6% salt, and for salty, longer fermenting misos, about twice as much beans as koji, with about 13% salt. These salt proportions are in relation to the weight of the dry ingredients. Here are hypothetical proportions for about 3 gallons or 12 liters of sweet miso. Make koji from 5 pounds or 2.25 kilograms, dry, of barley. Add that to the same dry weight of kidney beans. Then multiply the sum of those, in this case 10 pounds or 4.5 kilograms, by 6%, 0.06, to get 0.6 pound or 9.6 ounces, 0.27 kilograms, of salt, which roughly measures to 1 1/4 cups, 300 milliliters. With a salty miso, the same 5 pounds or 2.25 kilograms of barley koji could yield 5 gallons, 20 liters, of miso, because you mix it with twice as much beans, 10 pounds or 4.5 kilograms. To calculate salt, multiply the total dry weight of grains and beans, 15 pounds or 6.75 kilograms, by 13%, 0.13, to get 1.95 pounds or 0.88 kilograms salt, which roughly measures to 4 cups of salt. These are simple calculations that are the same no matter what unit of measure you are familiar with. You can estimate dry grain or bean weight at 2 cups per pound, or 1 liter per kilo. A given weight of salt will vary in its volume depending upon fineness or coarseness, and density, so weight is the most accurate gauge. There is no denying that miso is a salty food. Without heavy salting, beans rapidly putrefy. That said, you don't need to be a slave to these proportions. If you like, experiment with marginally smaller amounts of salt. I don't know exactly how little you can get away with. Salt in miso corresponds to the intended length of aging, so it's a question of how long it can beneficially age with a given proportion of salt. Miso Soup with William Shurtleff, co-author of The Book of Miso, The Book of Tempeh, and others. While I was writing this book, I paid a visit to William Shurtleff at his home, also the Soy Info Center, in Lafayette, California. From my first miso-making experience in 1994, his Book of Miso has been my guide. After years of email correspondence, I asked if I could come see him while I was visiting nearby San Francisco. I was thrilled when he invited me to come for a bowl of miso soup. Shurtleff has devoted himself in recent years to scholarship and achieving information about all aspects of the history of soybeans. He has translated early Chinese documents into English, created a chronological bibliography of written references to soy, and documented early U.S. commercial miso and tempeh makers. This is his life's work, and he is passionate not only about the subject, but also about the idea that this information be freely available. Most of the books he and his wife, Akiko Aoyagi, have written are available in full for free on Google Books, and all of their recent books have been self-published digitally, free of charge, on both Google Books and their website. Shurtleff loves what the Internet makes possible and wishes for the information and documentation he has compiled to aid and inspire people in far-flung locations to tap into the nutritional potential of soybeans. Bill Shurtleff's devotion to scholarship and archiving has taken his focus away from the kitchen. I can relate, as writing books and teaching have both impinged upon the hours I used to devote to the garden and the kitchen. When I presented Bill with a jar of homemade miso, he marveled that it had been many years since he had made miso. And in fact, when lunchtime came, he made a perfectly lovely soup from dried instant miso packets, enhanced with fresh grated ginger. In a way, it was like finally meeting the Wizard of Oz, seeing that the guru of miso making eats a powdered instant version of this ultimate slow food. Bill was very matter-of-fact about the whole thing. He is clear and unapologetic about his priorities. He also happens to have consulted with the people who first developed the process of drying miso into a powder for instant soups, so indeed he had a role in making what we ate. Throughout our meandering conversations, Bill kept referring back to the Buddhist notion of the middle way, of not embracing extremes or dogmatic views, of always finding value in different approaches, of striving for both/and inclusion rather than either/or restriction. The instant miso Bill served me also has bonito, fish, flakes in it, though he has practiced vegetarianism for 40 years, and that's how he became interested in miso in the first place. Again, he cited the middle way, the value of non-dogmatism. Bill seems quite at ease with seeming contradictions. Long-fermenting salty misos are typically made in the cool part of the year when airborne bacterial levels are relatively low. As a further guard against bacterial contamination, I usually sprinkle salt on the moist internal surfaces of the crock before filling it with miso. This is an idea recommended by Shurtleff and Aoyagi to increase the salt concentration at the edges. I do it unless I forget, and when I have forgotten, I have never had a problem with contamination. I think of it as a ritual of protection. More important, I also sprinkle salt a little more heavily on the surface before weighing down. I will not dwell too long on miso because Shurtleff and Aoyagi have not only covered the topic so comprehensively in The Book of Miso, but also have put that and many of their books online for all to freely access. Of the many traditional Japanese styles of miso Shurtleff and Aoyagi describe, my current favorites are two short-fermenting sweet misos. One, known as finger-lickin' miso, a traditional name, not one I bestowed, incorporates vegetables. In addition to equal parts koji and beans and 6% salt, for finger-lickin' miso, you add already fermenting vegetables in a proportion of roughly 10 to 25% of the rest by volume. Finger-lickin' miso is less a paste than a chunky chutney or pickle-type condiment. It tastes sweet, salty, and sour all at once with appealing textural variation. I usually start tasting it after about 2 weeks, and as time passes, it gets increasingly sour. Natto miso is another chunky sweet miso, distinguished by the fact that it maintains whole soybeans intact. One part whole-cooked soybeans are mixed with roughly 2 parts barley koji and 1 part shoyu, make sure it does not contain preservatives, along with kombu seaweed, barley malt, or another sweetener, and slivers of ginger, all mixed together and fermented 2 to 4 weeks. The shiny whole soybeans in natto miso resemble the beans in natto, a very different soybean ferment, natto, hence the name and a certain amount of confusion. For people interested in experimenting with miso but not wanting to wait a year or more, I recommend experimenting with finger-lickin' miso, natto miso, or other short-fermenting sweet styles.